This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're gonna love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In November 1987, Rafael Martinez was lucky to survive a gunshot wound to the head, but it changed the course of his life. Police reports said that the shooter's nickname was Chino. And according to some, Rafael lay in wait for 3 years before exacting his revenge. Meanwhile, the crack epidemic was raging, and in response, Congress decided to subsidize the misguided policy failure known as the War on Drugs. In New York, this meant increased funding to support investigations like the one that honed in on drug activity at Raphael's old apartment building in Upper Manhattan. Even though he had moved to Queens, according to the street-level dealers, Raphael controlled the local drug market. So the police relied on these smaller fish to catch someone who was allegedly a bigger one, tying in a few violent offenses to boot, including the murder of a man nicknamed Chino. But this is wrongful conviction. Wrongful conviction has always given voice to innocent people in prison. Now we're expanding that voice to you. Call us at 833-207-4666 and leave us a message. Tell us how these powerful, often tragic stories make you feel. Outraged, inspired, motivated? We want to know. We may even include your story in a future episode. Call us, 833-207-4666. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. Today's case, I was tempted to call it The Dead Guy Is Still Alive. I know that sounds crazy, but the murder victim is alive and well. Our guest today, Rafael Martinez, he was charged in connection to 3 violent incidents as well as a drug trafficking conspiracy. And so many people testified to support this narrative that made Rafael into a murderous drug kingpin, like something out of a movie, that you would have thought there must have been something to it. But when you take a closer look at who is testifying and why, the case falls apart. And how they went about constructing the case against him. That's one of the crimes we're covering. So we're going to go over that first before we get to all of the other absolutely insane details. And to help us do that, let's welcome back Rafael's attorney, the one and only Justin Bonas.
Thank you for having me again.
And calling in from Green Haven Penitentiary in New York State is the man himself, Rafael Martinez. Rafael, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
Yeah, now, Rafi, are you from the Dominican Republic or are you from New York?
I was born in Manhattan, in Harlem. Then I grew up in the Dominican Republic. Then when I was 18, I told my parents, listen, I would like to go back to the United States and finish my education in electric engineering. They sent me back to New York in 1985. I had a job in a factory. I came to live with my cousin in Washington Heights, 157th Street. That is a big Dominican community. Everybody knew each other. We used to hang out in front of the building. That was my social life right there. But there was a lot of poverty, and the drug was a major problem. That was the crack cocaine epidemic. And everybody was affected one way or another, directly or indirectly.
When Rafael was laid off from his factory job and struggling to get by, he too got involved, earning $5 for running an errand once that landed him on 5 years probation. And during that stretch of time, the crack epidemic had taken hold of at least one segment of most American cities. In New York, that was primarily Upper Manhattan and the Bronx, where, if you remember from the stories of Pablo Fernandez and Danny Rincon, both of which are going to be linked in the episode description, the largest and most feared drug organization at that time was led by Lenny and Nelson Sepulveda. They called themselves the Red Top Crew, but they were known in the media as the Wild Cowboys.
You had the Wild Cowboys that were out there. Everybody, at least on the Eastern Seaboard, was coming to Washington Heights and the Bronx for cocaine. The amount of money that was being made and violence. I mean, I believe in the 30th Precinct, which is only like a square mile. I think at one point they had 70 homicides a year in a square mile. I mean, that's just outrageous.
And Rafael was, in fact, a random victim of violence one night in November 1987.
I was asleep in my apartment in 157, and a stray bullet, he came through the window, struck me in the top of my head. The fire department had to break the way in so the police and paramedics can take me to the hospital. I lost part of the brain and part of the skull right on the top.
And Rafi has a significant limp. He has trouble moving. The right side of his body, police reports said that a guy named Chino did shoot him in the head. However, Chino was one of the most common Dominican nicknames,
which left police with little to go on. Meanwhile, Rafael stayed in the hospital until January 1988. He had no job, no savings. He lost his apartment on West 157th Street, so he ended up on public assistance while he continued to pursue his degree.
When I got out of the hospital in 1988, I went to live with my girlfriend. Then I moved to Queens around 1990.
Now, during this time, he and his girlfriend Merlin got married. He worked as a mechanic and started a family, but he still kept in touch with the community on West 157th Street. Meanwhile, the crack epidemic continued to rage on. And in response, Congress passed the Anti-Drug Abuse Act in 1988, which funded high-intensity drug trafficking area task forces throughout the country. Now, in New York, that meant funding for a coordinated effort among detectives and DAs from all five boroughs on drug-related cases. And in Washington Heights, NYPD Detective James Gilmore was empowered to lead a two-year investigation starting in 1989, specifically focusing on drug activity at two of Rafi's old apartment buildings, 550 and 614 West 157th Street.
They took 42 hours of video surveillance. And I only appear in one video. In that video, I'm not doing anything illegal, nothing.
They also took a ton of photos. Also, nothing. However, Gilmore ran several sting operations between July 29th and October 12th, 1991, in which some of the people from 157th Street who turned into cooperatives in this case sold cocaine and firearms to undercover agents. In the last operation, they arrested a young woman from that area named Ira Venus, who was about to hop on a flight to Switzerland with several kilos of cocaine. Needless to say, she was also ready to cooperate, as were those who were scooped up in a mass arrest on October 22, 1991, including two of Rafi's brothers, Danny and Julian.
Rafi has like four brothers. Some of them were selling drugs. The amount of drugs that they were selling was highly debatable.
They also picked up Rafi's uncle, Isidoro Medina de Leon, whose involvement was even more debatable. But what was different about this wholesale arrest was that they made another arrest in a different jurisdiction.
I was arrested, getting out of my place of residence that was in Queens. That was me, Cesar Martinez, and Lorenzo Martinez. They will not draw weapon, money, anything illegal on the car.
Involvement with anything illegal can make you vulnerable to police coercion, which made Rafi's brothers, Danny and Julian, as well as others from West 157th Street, well, very vulnerable, including Edwin Matos, Jordan Pratt, Daniel Colon, Ira Venus, Pedro Santiago, Andre Gomez, Roberto Medina, and Manuel Picon.
They were arrested with drugs, with weapons. After they get some of those guys to cooperate with them, they came up with this conspiracy indictment for everybody.
Gilmore and his team had devised a narrative for any willing cooperator to support that while on 5 years probation, partially disabled, raising a family, and living on public assistance in Queens, Rafael somehow built a multi-million dollar crack empire on West 157th Street, rivaling the Red Top crew, and they were called the Jerry Curl Gang. Now, you might be asking, why Rafi? And we'll get to that, but first, we'll finish covering how.
There was a lot of surveillance, okay, with regard to the drugs. There's plenty of evidence against the cooperators, but there's not so much evidence against Rafi and Lorenzo. With Rafi, there's actually a lack of evidence, even with regard to the drugs.
James Gilmore, he testified in court that he never saw me selling drugs or engaging in violence.
And they did not call themselves the Jerry Curl Gang. That's something that the media came up with.
The whole Washington High and the Dominican community has the Jerry Curl at that time. But when they arrested everybody, they said everybody has the same hairstyle. Oh, that's the Jerry Curl Gang. And they admitted in court that they made that up.
The Jerry Curl moniker began and ended with law enforcement, and it was used to connect three seemingly unrelated violent incidents to drug activity on West 157th Street, and its alleged overseers, Rafael, and his co-defendants, Lorenzo and Cesar Martinez, his uncle Isidoro Medina de Leon, as well as a man named Roberto Gonzalez. The first incident was the August 29th, 1990, attempted murder of Rafael Espinal on Park Terrace and 215th Street.
With regard to the attempted murder of Rafael Espinal, there was barely any investigation. He named someone else Espinal. He tells the police, Rafael Molina is the one that shot me.
Yet cooperators Edwin Matos and Pedro Santiago alleged that Rafael Martinez had ordered his uncle Isidoro to kill Espinal for robbing his brother Danny. Then Matos, Santiago, and Rafi's brother Julian also testified about a car that got shot up on October 29, 1990 in the Bronx at East 167th Street and College Avenue. The deceased was identified as Jose Jimenez, whose nickname was thought to be Chino. The surviving victim was Juan Urena, said the shooter was a man named Franklin. They canvassed the area, documented the crime scene, but the case went cold for about 6 months. Decades later, an undisclosed police report surfaced in which a confidential informant appears to have been key in shifting Gilmore's investigation to focus on Rafael Martinez.
The confidential informant told the homicide investigator in April 1991 that allegedly Jose Jimenez was the one who shot me, and therefore I used to have a dispute with Jose Jimenez.
As a result, it appears that Rafael's 1987 stray bullet became the catalyst placing him at the center of Gilmore's drug investigation.
So the theme here is retribution, that Rafi waits on Jose Jimenez for close to 3 years, somehow gets information that Jose Jimenez is in the Bronx somewhere, and Rafi, Lorenzo, and Isidoro Medina pull up next to Jose Jimenez and Juan Urena in a car, and Rafi, who's in the passenger seat, and Lorenzo, who's in the back passenger seat, fire into the car, and Jose and Juan Urena got shot.
Investigators initially tried to get Rafi's brother Danny to testify to this version of events.
The prosecution wanted him to testify that he went with us. He said no, and he got out only for conspiracy to sell drugs.
So Danny took his lumps rather than passing the buck. Cesar Martinez also faced a similar challenge and chose to take his chances at trial as a co-defendant. But Rafi's brother Julian became the source of this version of events that is simply not supported by the undisputed facts of the crime. At least one of the fatal shots had a downward trajectory. Now, how would that be possible with a seated shooter in a car next to the victims?
forensically, that's not possible. The shell casings were found in the front of the car. There is medical evidence that the shooting was conducted by somebody who was standing, not sitting. There's at least one eyewitness account that basically describes a man named Franklin Cuevas walked in front of the car and fired into the car. There's a DD5 where Juan Urania actually says Franklin from 172nd and Audubon, which is where Franklin Cuevas was from in Washington Heights, is the one that fired into the car.
Yet the police ignored the forensics, ballistics, and again, the surviving victim for their team of cooperators and their theory. And it appears this pattern continued with the murder of Jose Reyes, the building super at 614 West 157th Street. According to testimony from Julian Martinez, Rafael believed Reyes was an informant and put a $3,500 bounty on his head. Then, around 2:30 p.m. on May 23, 1991, near Broadway and 159th Street, Jose Reyes was shot in the back of the head with a .45. Then, Pedro Santiago showed up for the third time with alleged information.
And the interesting thing about Pedro Santiago, who was definitely selling a lot of drugs, this individual is caught up in a whole different case where he specifically says in that other case that he barely knew the Martinez brothers. Then he comes in Rafi and Lorenzo's case, and he says that by September of 1989, he began to work daily with Rafi and Lorenzo, and he became a lieutenant in their crew. In the other case, he said he didn't meet him until midway through 1991.
So which one was it? Was Santiago a lieutenant in an alleged drug organization, privy to information about the three separate murders between August 1990 and May of 91? Or did he only meet the Martinez brothers after these incidents had already taken place?
This is what I'm saying. I don't know what's true in this case with regard to the witnesses that the state puts on.
Santiago claimed to have seen Lorenzo Martinez meet with his co-defendant Roberto Gonzalez, then heard the gunshots from about a quarter of a mile away.
I think Pedro Santiago gets a 1-3 and he's cut loose right away.
Just like all the other cooperators in this case, including David Colon, who also testified about the Reyes murder, like Santiago, Colon claimed that he heard the gunshots, then later saw Gonzalez with a gun. Then Colon claimed that he later borrowed a .45 from Gonzalez, then lost it when he lent it to an unidentified person. How convenient. Then Colon alleged that Gonzalez wasn't angry since it rid him of an alleged murder weapon. Another unverifiable account. The only thing we know for sure about the Reyes murder was the date, time, place, and caliber of bullet, because the witnesses are so totally unreliable, which is true across this entire prosecution.
Essentially, the cooperators get arrested based upon the investigation into the drug dealing, and then all of a sudden, Rafi becomes this boss. And the murders and the attempted murders are what was used to make him look like this animal.
You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. Freedom Agenda is a proud sponsor of this episode of Wrongful Conviction. Freedom Agenda is led by people directly impacted by incarceration, and they're organizing to get Mayor Eric Adams to follow the law and shut down Rikers Island. Right now, thousands of people are awaiting trial there in life-threatening conditions. Freedom Agenda is committed to creating a safer and more just city by winning investments in long-neglected communities, protecting the rights of people involved in the criminal legal system, and ending the cycle of violence that Rikers perpetuates. To learn more about the campaign to close Rikers and to sign up for Freedom Agenda's mailing list, go to campaigntoclosericers.org/get involved or follow at Freedom Agenda NY on social media.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+. Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
There is no physical evidence connecting me to anything, but by the testimony of the cooperating witnesses, they say, oh, whatever I got arrested with was because Rafael Martinez told me to do it. Whatever they saw doing undercover, they charged me to constructing, selling, and constructing, possessing the drugs. They only had to connect my mind. They only had to say, oh, Rafael was the boss. That's it. That was more than enough for them to find me guilty.
Rafael was charged with conspiracy, along with various drug and firearm possession and sales charges, as well as the attempted murder of Rafael Espinal and the murders of Jose Reyes and Jose Jimenez. An assistant DA, Fernando Camacho, tried Rafael and his four co-defendants for over 4 months in front of the notorious hanging judge, Leslie Crocker Snyder.
The thing about Leslie Crocker Snyder, just taking it back historically, sometime in the mid-80s, the Manhattan DA's office created this homicide investigative unit. And a lot of times, from what I've gathered, is they actually would do search warrants and feed those search warrants to Leslie Crocker Snyder. She was somebody who they knew that they could trust in handling high-profile cases. Inappropriately, by the way.
To that point, Richard Giampa, Rafael's attorney, found and raised the DD-5 containing Juan Urena's identification of Franklin from 172nd Street and Audubon as his and Jose Jimenez's shooter.
But that piece of evidence was suppressed by Leslie Crocker Snyder. She told the defense attorneys at trial that, well, if they don't know Franklin's last name, then it's not credible evidence that Franklin committed this shooting.
Then it appears she was aware of hidden deals for cooperators.
The main witnesses all testified that they received certain deals, free to life. And the second that they testified, they were immediately let loose. We have transcripts which shows that Leslie Crocker Snyder knew what was going on and they were given time served, which is vastly different than a three to life sentence.
According to an affidavit from Rafael's ex-wife, Merlin Martinez, she recorded Julian Martinez over the phone. When she asked why he was lying about his own brother, Julian described the coercion and threats being used against him and other cooperators. She then described how she sat in court while Judge Crocker Snyder and ADA Camacho heard the recording, at the end of which Crocker Snyder threatened to charge whoever had made this illegal recording. Never mind the fact that New York is a one-party consent state. So that sure seems like selective outrage.
And then you have the fact that Julian Martinez has said that the prosecutor actually would bring him into the district attorney's office, that he was baited with food, drugs, and he was allowed to have sex with women, including his girlfriend.
It also comes to light many years later that Camacho had also promised many of the cooperators safety from deportation.
A lot of these witnesses weren't here legally. Nobody knew that they received benefits, which entailed keeping them in the country. This is just one thing after another.
So it appears that all of the cooperators were receiving the carrot and the stick, importantly, out of view from the jury.
Even Rafael Espinal and Juan Urena had convictions that they were looking at. I mean, Juan Urena, who's in the car with Jimenez, so he'd be an eyewitness. He does not identify Rafael Lorenzo or Isidore Medina, by the way. However, he testifies with the benefit of a lawyer because he's worried about his drug arrest in Connecticut that he ends up getting probation for. Espinal testified with a lawyer, and he had charges pending.
And as we mentioned, Espinal initially named Rafael Marina as the shooter, but at trial, they somehow got him to morph Marina into Martinez. So the deck was clearly stacked, starting with Camacho's opening statement that laid out a totally unfounded theory of Rafael's 1987 gunshot wound.
Camacho, he said it. Jose Jimenez used to be one of my workers. He used to be one of my friends. And he went to the apartment and he shot me in the back of my head and stole from me $50,000 and 3 kilos of cocaine. Remember, at that time in 1987, I was only 20 years old. My apartment was paid by welfare, and I had never been shot in the back of my head. The stray bullet struck me in the top of my head.
When they were investigating the murder of Jose Jimenez and investigated whether he was the one that shot Rafi, the NYPD found that there was no substance to that claim.
But that wasn't discovered for decades, long after Camacho had said these things in front of the jury. And that really is the original sin of this entire case, this unfounded motive. But nevertheless, they continued pursuing Rafael with a team of cooperating witnesses who in reality hadn't actually seen anything.
Pratt, Venus, Julian, and Santiago all testified that they heard Rafi admit that he killed Jose Jimenez. Julian, though, specifically describes how the murder happens. They pull up next to Jose Jimenez and they open fire on the side of the car.
As was mentioned, the shell casings were found in front of the car, and one of the fatal shots had a downward trajectory, suggesting a standing mobile shooter. But none of this was pointed out to the jury. In addition, the state's medical examiner, Dr. Joseph Varess, gave testimony that in part corroborated this erroneous version of events by saying that stippling may have been on the victim's face, which is a typical accompanying injury whenever there's a close-range gunshot.
If the cars line up with each other and Rafi allegedly reaches across, blows the window out, and shoots this man point-blank in the head, then there would be stippling all over the person's face. The medical examiner testified that stippling either can go through glass or it can follow through the bullet hole and end up all over a person's face. And when we had our medical examiner review that, Sir Wecht, he's never heard of that in his 60 years of being a medical examiner, that stippling could go through glass. It's a physical impossibility. And then specifically, the ME noted on his autopsy report that he couldn't tell whether it was stippling or dicing. Now, what dicing is when a window is blown out and you get cuts from the window hitting a person's face, which would be more likely in this case because there's bullet holes in the front of the windshield and then the driver's side window is blown out and the glass is found all over the place.
But only this erroneous potential of stippling was mentioned in front of the jury, which supported the close-range gunshot theory. The jury also heard from the state's ballistic expert, Charles Hopkins, who testified that a .45 caliber and a 9mm were used in the Jimenez murder and were also found in the possession of individuals who were affiliated with the Martinezes.
The guy that gets arrested with the .45 is not connected to Rafi. The 9 comes from Julian. We spoke to Julian, and Julian specifically said he bought the gun from Kubita, who was a member of Franklin Cuevas' crew.
Just like Juan Urena's identification of Franklin Cuevas, the jury could and should have benefited from this information. Even though Julian never said that at trial, years later, he recanted, along with Edwin Matos and Jordan Pratt. Pedro Santiago's testimony in another case destroyed his credibility in this one. And then there's Ira Venus.
Ira Venus said that Rafi taped I don't know how many kilos of cocaine on her and sent her to Switzerland. And Rafi was in the Dominican Republic on the day that happened. So the prosecutor had to concede that she lied about that.
Airline tickets were presented to corroborate Rafi's alibi. In addition, Ira Venus testified about Rafi's alleged intentions to kill Jose Jimenez. For her testimony, she received time served. And believe it or not, the Jimenez murder investigation got even worse. But we'll get to that later. Now, the murder of Jose Reyes. Julian testified about the alleged bounty. Santiago and Colon both testified about what they saw before and after, but neither of them claimed to have seen the shooting, rather that they had heard it. from about a quarter of a mile away.
And Roberto Gonzalez's lawyers, he hired an expert witness. And this expert took the noise level from a weapon used in that murder. And he came to the conclusion that it was impossible for the cooperating witnesses to hear that shot that killed Jose Reyes all the way down there in 157 on Riverside.
Which impeached these witnesses enough for the jury, as Lorenzo Martinez and Roberto Gonzalez were acquitted of that murder. But unfortunately, the attorney who Rafael's parents hired right before trial wasn't afforded the time to tackle the broad scope of Rafi's charges.
Richard Giampa gets hired during the pretrial hearing, and the judge refuses to give Richard Giampa an adjournment to prepare for trial. So right after the pretrial hearing, they go into trial. And this is all Leslie Crocker Snyder's doing. And when Richard Giampa would fight with her, she would punish him and admonish him in front of the jury.
And Fernando Camacho also attacked him in front of the jury.
This is Camacho quoting, "Mr. Giampa, the man has been on the case for 5 months. I have offered him an opportunity to look at all the evidence. He makes it seem like he's being blindsided. He is simply totally unprepared and using this as an excuse."
How are you investigating during a 4-month-long trial while you're in court from 9 to 5? Getting sandbagged. There's no way he could have won. You don't know that the witnesses are getting deals that aren't what they're testifying to.
And then there's the things that Giampa did know, that Julian Martinez had admitted that the cooperators were being coerced. But when Judge Crocker Snyder heard the recording, strangely, she took issue with the recording, but not the unreliability of the state's witnesses. Later, she accused Giampa of paranoid delusions. Yet she's the one who suppressed Juan Urena's identification of an alternate suspect.
Frankie Cuevas, he gets murdered in 1993. How many other people does he shoot and kill? They knew that this guy was the one who killed him. It's in a police report that he's the killer.
So deprived of this kind of critical exculpatory information, the deals received by cooperators, calling him a violent drug kingpin, while the crack epidemic continued outside the courthouse, it was a fait accompli. So on April 8th, 1993, Rafael was predictably, wrongly convicted of various drug and firearm charges, also conspiracy, attempted murder, and the murder of Jose Jimenez. And per Judge Crocker Snyder, the sentences were to run consecutively, totaling 213 years to life.
During the sentencing proceeding, Mr. Camacho, this is him talking, "For years, hardworking, law-abiding people have been coming to this country, and through hard work, they have made it. In a sense, Rafael Martinez is also successful. He was a multimillionaire by the age of 25, but he didn't do it with sweat and hard work. He did it with violence and drugs. He has taken a wonderful concept and made it endure. Somehow, Rafael Martinez built an empire on 157th Street, and he decided that the black belonged to him, an act of pure arrogance."
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, "Well, I had this career before, but it was a waste." And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From 1967 to 1991, when I got arrested, nobody in this world can say that I raised my hand to be violent towards somebody. Since 91 to today, I am living in the worst condition a human being can be placed in. This place is violent. They have all types of drugs, contraband, weapons. But over 32 years, I have a now changing record. I have never raised my hands to hurt anyone.
Rafael also continued his education inside the walls, studying theology and the law. As Lorenzo and Isidoro fought their innocence claims alongside him, but they didn't gain any traction on appeal.
It's very difficult when you have this many witnesses. I mean, back in 1999, Isidoro Medina actually obtained the first two recantations of the main cooperators.
In 1999, Jordan Pratt and Edwin Mato executed an affidavit about what they went through with the district attorney office in order for them to cooperate and fabricate this evidence in my case. All the benefit that they got, they were allowed to have sex inside the Manhattan District Attorney's office.
Isidoro Medina filed a post-conviction motion that got denied.
In addition to Edwin Matos and Jordan Pratt, Julian Martinez also recanted in 2013, which began a rethinking of the crime scene. In addition, an eyewitness of the Jimenez murder named Russell Harris swore an affidavit, also naming Franklin Cuevas, and his description of the crime aligned perfectly with the forensics as well.
You know, Rafi files a blockbuster motion back in 2015 with recantations, his alibi, this whole crime scene recreation where the crime couldn't have happened the way Julian testified, and it gets thrown out. So I get involved the summer of 2017.
Justin scoured through the trial transcripts and requested Rafi's files from the Manhattan DA's office, and he found two DD-5s, or police reports, that contradicted the state's theory at trial.
Those police reports contradicted the testimony of Jordan Pratt and Julian, which is that Rafi commits this murder in the car that's usually driven by the Martinez brothers, which was a gold and black colored car. There were two eyewitnesses from above, and they say the car that was in the area was a white Toyota. And those two DD-5s were not turned over at trial.
And then looking into Franklin Cuevas, who was known to have driven a white Toyota, it became clear that he was affiliated with, get this, none other than the leader of the Red Top crew, Lenny Sepulveda, as well as his associate, Jose Yaca.
I send my private investigator out to speak to Lenny Sepulveda and Jose Yaca. And Lenny, by the way, has cooperated many times for the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. Lenny says that Franklin Cuevas was a certified killer, and Lenny knew him. Back in 82, Frankie went to jail for manslaughter, came home in 1989. Lenny set him up with a block and some drugs. And a part of Frankie's crew was a guy named Speedy. Speedy gets killed in 1989, either before or after Frankie comes home. And Speedy and Frankie were the same age. They came up together and Frankie takes vengeance. And Jose Yaca gives an affidavit where Jose Yaca specifically says that Frankie kills Chino.
Now they had Franklin Cuevas's motive, but what about Rafi's alleged motive? Justin found the confidential informant's DD5, and it turned out that this informant was actually an eyewitness.
The problem with this individual for the government is that essentially this individual says that they're there and that they don't see Rafael Martinez at the scene. That's never turned over to defense. The police follow up on this allegation that Rafael Martinez and Jose Jimenez have a beef, that Jose Jimenez is the one that shot Rafi in 87 in another DD5. And they determined that there's no substance to that allegation. So that Jose Jimenez was not the guy that shoots Rafael Martinez in the head in 1987. Okay, this is independent evidence. That wasn't turned over.
So Rafael never had a motive. And with that, Justin and his co-counsel, Oscar Michelin, filed Rafi's initial 440 motion in December 2020.
The initial motion to vacate is about Franklin, how the witnesses lied about the deals they got. And it's about how the forensic evidence shows that the way that the witnesses testified the crime happened did not happen that way.
But then what happened?
An explosion, okay? I believe it was April of 2021 when Lorenzo bumped into a guy in Sing Sing that said, hey, you know, the guy in your case that you allegedly murdered with your brother, I did his appeal.
Yeah, this is how it gets even worse. Because in addition to Franklin Cuevas, the Bronx DA was also after Jose Jimenez and his brother Raymond for the murder of Armando Speedy Baez in 1989. And Jose Jimenez was clearly not killed in October of 1990 because he was convicted in 1991.
And we get his appellate brief and I'm like, wait a second. This can't be the case. This is insane. I do my due diligence. We get the indictment. We then go to the Manhattan DA's office. They give us more information that supports that the brother that's allegedly dead is actually alive.
Justin and Oscar then received some of the Bronx DA's file for the Speedy Baez murder case.
They gave us specific documents relating to the identity of the brothers. Jose Jimenez's nickname was not Chino. Raymond Jimenez's nickname was Chino. Jose Jimenez's nickname was Junior. Okay? It made us look at the police reports all over again. The actual initial police report says that Raymond Jimenez is the one that's dead, and not Jose Jimenez. And to watch the changing of the name, when you have this confidential informant give up that Rafi has a beef with Jose Jimenez, now it's Jose Jimenez that's dead. It's outrageous.
Also in the Bronx file were all the details of the Baez murder. How on May 14th, 1989, Raymond Chino Jimenez handed his brother Jose Jr. Jimenez a gun, and Jose Jr. fatally shot Armando Speedy Baez in front of 2427 Webster Avenue in the Bronx. The Jimenez brothers were indicted on August 3rd of 89, but then the indictment changed when Raymond Chino Jimenez was killed on October 29th, 1990, and his brother Jose Jr. identified the body the next day. There was also documentation of why Jose Jr. was tried in absentia.
At Jose Jimenez's sentencing hearing in September of 1991, there were two witnesses that came in that gave affidavits that explained that Jose Jimenez ran from his trial because he was terrified of the guys that killed his brother.
Jose Jr. also gave an affidavit on July 22, 1991 to the same effect. Either way, Jose Jr. was alive, convicted, arrested, and sent away for 25 to life. And it appears that this should have come to light before or during Rafi's trial.
In the middle of the trial, my lawyer asked, can we have Jose Jimenez criminal record? The district attorney said, oh, I don't know if I can pull that up because he's already dead, but I will check and I will let you know in the afternoon session. He came back at 1 o'clock and said, oh, he has no criminal record. Jose Jimenez was doing 25 to life in New York State prison. How are you going to say he has no criminal record?
Fernando Camacho is currently a judge out in Suffolk County, Long Island. So it turns out that not only was Jose Jr. still alive when Rafael was tried in 1993, but also, as far as we know, he's still alive and well as we record this episode right now in early spring of 2024.
How I know Jose Jimenez is alive in the Dominican Republic is through his direct appeal And then you can look him up on the New York State inmate locator. And it says deported 2016, which lines up perfectly to him going in September of 1991.
And yet no one was ever brought to justice for his brother Raymond's murder.
It's not like they don't have a body. They do have a body, right? It's that they didn't care. They built this narrative. At some point, whether it was willfully or inadvertently, they made a mistake. And then they refused to correct it. And then they framed Raffi and Lorenzo and their uncle for the murder of a man that's alive. The government has actually admitted, they've conceded that Jose Jimenez is alive. Their position is that it's not material enough to warrant a new trial.
Jesus. So the dead guy's alive, and I'm completely at a loss. How is the guy who was killed being alive? How's that not material? I mean, I don't know what else the DA's office could possibly need to see here. Yeah, I'm a little boondoggled by this one, I gotta say. And with that, we're gonna go to closing arguments. I'm gonna thank you both for sharing this truly insane story. It's literally unlike any other one we've ever done. And now I'm going to just sit back in my chair and just listen for anything else you want to share with me and our amazing audience. We call this section Closing Arguments. Justin, I'm going to turn it over to you for any takeaways you might have. And then you turn it over to Raffi and he'll take us off into the sunset.
I don't know. Takeaways are the criminals run the justice system. This was criminal. And the question is how many people were involved with it, right? I mean, you have all these police officers, these cooperating witnesses that they knew were testifying falsely. So you have a prosecutor who, at the very least, was not sure who was dead. I mean, if you're just not sure, say it. Say, I don't know. Maybe this was a mistaken identity. That's not what he did. He doubled down on it. Meanwhile, Jose Jimenez is sitting in state prison. Everyone should be frightened at the power of our government to prosecute people like this.
I just would like to say to Abin Brad that I have so much respect for him, but I think he shouldn't be afraid or hesitate to do the right thing in my case, because anyone who knows me will see that I am a fine person, very respectful, loving person, and everybody's safe around me because I am innocent. I was prosecuted for allegedly killing Jose Jimenez. We found that he is alive. There is no reason to go any further. It's over. I just care about being a free man. Please, just look at the evidence. The evidence and the rule of law is what is going to set me free.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy. Yeah. Right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast.
Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're going to love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Dura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.